Hello, everybody. Welcome to Oncology Decoded, where cancer science meets clarity. Ben and I are here today. Sincerely thankful to all of you. Always looking forward to hearing your thoughts and ideas as to how you're approaching GU cancer as we keep hearing about newer data that's emerging from all of our major conferences that's going on. We are not recording on a Friday, even though typically that is our day, but Ben and I just came back from ASCO GU. Ben, before we get started, any thoughts?
No, I think it was a really good conference. I think we're going to talk about some really exciting data. And I'll just say, you know, we're a little delayed, right, in our podcast here because we were traveling for ASCO GU. We had spring break. We're both family men. We had to take care of that. And that's why we're not recording on a Friday for those of you listening. But also, you know, we've been doing some exciting things recently. We've been talking ex-US on this podcast. We did a GI episode, but now we're going back to our roots, right? And I think the key is let's break down this new GU data. It was a great conference, a good time to catch up with friends and colleagues, but also some really, really practice-changing things. And I think we should just start with, I'm just going to ask you, what is the number one most practice-changing trial in your opinion?
Yeah, the number one practice-changing trial that is kind of like, we need to make this change now was the EV-304 study, right? So this was the biggest practice impact. It basically looked at patients who are muscle invasive bladder cancer undergoing a neoadjuvant therapy. So this is looking at perioperative and fortamatinib vedotin plus pembrolizumab, and it beat out neoadjuvant gemcitabine cisplatin with significant interval improvements in event-free survival, overall survival, and pathologic complete response rates. AMH showed a PAT CR rate of 56%, and this is now going to be the new perioperative benchmark that we have to hit in order to keep moving our advancement in bladder cancer. So really, this is kind of like, even though the FDA approval, I don't think came in yet, it's going to be, this is the one that we're going to be using moving forward for all patients in the perioperative space, whether they are platinum eligible or ineligible. So this is probably the landmaking thing. What would you say is the most landmark trial?
I agree. It's important to have pembrolizumab perioperative. It's paradigm shifting. We're now removing chemotherapy from the perioperative landscape in most cases in advanced T2 muscle invasive or greater urothelial carcinoma. And you might ask, I mean, should all T2s get this? And I think the answer is probably yes. I mean, this is transformational data, very high past CR rates, very nice overall survival data, or at least, you know, relapse-free survival data. This looks incredibly powerful. And it looks very similar to the data we saw at ESMO in the cisplatin-ineligible population, this being in the cisplatin-eligible population. Now, I already have hypothesized it might look better. It didn't look better, but it looked similar. And it's performing at a very, very high rate. So I think this is it. I think they've left us with only a few questions, which isn't should we give it, it's how much of it should we give. Right. And that's a separate thing maybe that we need to decode. But I think that this is it. And I think it's the best regimen out there for perioperative cancer.
So Ben, let me ask you, you know, historically, from the time that I finished my fellowship and even the last few years, there's always been, you know, the first thing we have to figure out for any patient that we're seeing for bladder cancer is platinum eligibility. You know, cisplatin eligibility, the criteria for figuring out what cisplatin eligibility looks like and who gets cisplatin, who doesn't get cisplatin. Now, when we're rethinking bladder cancer at this point, you know, the big approach to me at this point is surgery versus no surgery, as opposed to cisplatin versus no cisplatin. How would you think about the algorithm, quote unquote, if you would, to say, when you're seeing this patient in a muscle-invasive bladder cancer, whether they have no positive or no negative, as long as they don't have extensive distant metastasis, where would you kind of say, this is the fork, I need to make this decision point before I can keep moving forward? And how do you break that though?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the first thing is, with no offense to Dr. Galsky, but the cisplatin eligibility criteria is no longer relevant in perioperative disease. We're going to give EVP to everyone. So it doesn't matter what your kidney function is, right? We're going to give this drug. And then the question is, well, how do we consolidate? Is this drug powerful enough to be cystectomy sparing? Maybe. We don't know that yet. That's a leap too far for our, you know, standard of care practices. But I think we give the regimen, You give three or four cycles, really doesn't matter. We don't really know how many you need. Those trials were conducted in different ways. One trial in the cisplatin ineligible group was three cycles, cisplatin eligible group was four cycles. So I think you could go away with either because we're seeing similar past CR rates. You have three or four cycles of therapy, and then you do another cystoscopy, and you decide at that point, should I do a consolidative surgery or should I do consolidative radiotherapy, right? And I don't think we have more data behind surgery. So I think unless a patient is refusing the cystectomy, that should probably be the path of least resistance and going EV Pembro surgery and then more EV Pembro in the adjuvant setting, though if they start to develop neuropathy, probably quick withdrawal of enfortumab vedotin in that setting. But I think that's probably the way we should be doing it. Forgetting about platinum eligibility for now, unless they recur and need chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. But I do think very few patients are going to recur. And I think we have a lot of work to do. And some of that's going to be on our shoulders and some of that's going to be on the shoulders of the academic community. But we're going to have to figure out how do we figure out how much enfortumab vedotin somebody needs in the adjuvant setting, right? To complete a year of therapy. I think that's going to be too much EV, but probably need to do the full course of the pembrolizumab for now. Can we use ctDNA in that setting? The answer is probably, but we don't know yet. And with the cure rates as high as they are, I think we have to be respectful to the perioperative program as of now, at least in March 2026. And then I think, you know, from there, we need to figure out what's the best consolidated modality between surgery and radiation. But for now, I'd say surgery would be the standard bearer, but radiation would be quite reasonable.
Yeah. So if I'm hearing you right, I think your bridge point that you're talking about is is similar to what I'm saying, which is figure out if a patient's eligible or wants to proceed with surgery. And if they do, then EVP would be your regimen to go to, and platinum eligibility no longer matters in the treatment paradigm of these patients.
Even if they don't, is it different for you?
Even if they don't what? Proceed to surgery?
They don't want surgery. What do they want? Radiation.
Yeah, I think I actually asked a different question. And the reason I say that is because technically for bladder sparing, we have not seen the data that says that EVP alone is going to be sufficient where you don't need to do anything more. Mm-hmm. So in that space specifically, have I done things different? Absolutely, right? So have I had patients that come to me and say, I don't want to do surgery and I don't want to do radiation. What are you going to do? Or what are my options? Then I would still recommend EVP and then see how it goes. And then cystoscopy, ctDNA, maybe just observation. But again, this is a completely data-free zone. We know that there are some patients who did not undergo surgery based on the data trials that have been already presented with EVP, but we can't really say that that's going to be standard of care at this point, right? But is that the future? Probably, but we just don't know.
Well, I want to push you a little bit because that's not quite the question I was asking, because I agree. We need to, until we can prove that we don't, we need to be doing consolidation, right? Surgery or radiation. Let's say a patient comes to your clinic. They've seen the urologist. They don't want a cystectomy. They want definitive chemo radiation, right? Which is, you know, we see these patients. It's totally reasonable for a patient to decide. What do you give them?
Yeah. If they want definitive therapy and they don't want surgery, I think the quote unquote textbook answer is still 5-FU, mitomycin, or Gemzar with radiotherapy, right? But do you have to follow that? The short answer is no. I would probably still give you EDP and then think about how to consolidate them afterwards.
That's what I'm doing. And I'm going to bail you out because I know you're a little bit hesitant about going off script. I'm fully free to be wrong. So I'm just going to throw it out there. But we've had these patients in my clinic, and I'll tell you what I'm doing, because I feel like it is better than the NCCN guidelines. You give your EVP for three. Not going to surgery. Fine. We're going to give definitive chemo radiotherapy. So EVP for a few cycles. I'm not giving away the chemo sensitizer. We still need that. We haven't proved you don't. But then I'm not going to go with 5-FU of mitomycin. I'm either going to go with the palliative low dose gemcitabine, which is, you know, twice a week at a lower dose regimen, or maybe the weekly cyst if they're cyst eligible. So I'm going to give the full chemo radiotherapy, but I am going to debulk them with EVP first, not knowing that that's correct, but it's hard for me to ignore the transformational nature of that regimen and also that micrometastatic disease that we're wiping up. The whole part of the point of neoadjuvant therapy, kind of do that on the chemo radiotherapy side. I've actually been prior to chemo radiotherapy in my EVP data set. So again, that might be overkill, but that is what I'm doing. It sounds like that's probably what you're doing as well for those patients. But, you know, it's hard to actually recommend that because it's totally not in the guidelines. So I'm putting an asterisk. This is not medical recommendation in our podcast here, even though I'm saying that's what I would do.
Yeah, I'm being a little bit more cautious in giving that exact kind of recommendation because I am, Paul, I'm doing very similar to what you're saying. My only challenge is that it's not a...
Isn't, correct.
And I say that because we're talking really about, you know, if somebody has strictly a T2 disease, am I going to do all of that for somebody who does not wish to undergo surgery? I don't know that I will, right? I think it has to be more tailored in that situation. But certainly someone who does not wish to undergo surgery and has bulkier disease where they have a node positive or a T4, then yeah, I think their risk of distant metastasis is far greater. So I think we have to think more about how to approach that from that standpoint. That's my hesitation in answering your question as directly as you are.
Level-headed answer. Very level-headed, very reasonable. Couldn't argue with it at all. But okay, I think that's good on EVP. Is there anything else we need to mention or should we move on to the next big topic?
No, I don't think I have anything else that says anything else for specific for bladder cancer at this point. I think we can move on. See, I talked about bladder cancer to begin, saying that was my biggest thing. What do you think is the next biggest trial or the next two biggest trials that came out of this meeting?
I think it's kidney cancer. I think it's HIF inhibition. And I think there's two studies, right? So I'm going to get the numbers wrong here. Maybe not. I'm actually going to look to make sure because there's LightSpark 011. Yes, this is, I going to think, a little bit more into practice the quickest. We might argue which. But 011 is the second, third cancer study in the metastatic setting comparing lenvatinib and belzutifan to a true standard of care, which is cabozantinib. We all know that cabozantinib is kind of that go-to second-line drug. You got ipi-nivo, you're getting cabo. You got pembroaxi, you're getting cabo, right? Now, if you got cabo-nivo up front, that's a little bit different. But that is a really good control arm is my point. And they looked at this and they looked at the combination. And the median progression-free survival was 14.8 months for belzutifan and lenvatinib versus 10.7 months for cabozantinib. So that is actually a pretty significant, in my opinion, meaningful difference. Median overall survival, 34 versus 27 months. Pretty reasonable. And then the response rate was 10% higher at 52 versus 40%. So when I put all that together, I'm like, well, yes, of course this is better because we know belzutifan is an active drug. It's got an FDA approval after IO and TKI. We know lenvatinib is a very active TKI. We saw phase 2 data, lenvatinib and everolimus versus cabozantinib, where the combination of two drugs with lenvatinib was a little bit better than cabo. That was phase 2 with all the caveats there. But this is a big phase 3. And I think that, yes, this is a good combination for anyone that wants to prioritize response, prioritize PFS. There's more side effects, but actually, not that many. Actually, the side effect profiles were more similar than different, a little bit more anemia and hypoxia, of course, with the HIP combination. But I was shocked that it wasn't more toxic than it was, right? So overall, I think it's a very good combination. I think it will lead to an FDA approval, even though we don't have a statistically significant overall survival, though it's trending in the right direction. It's a second-line drug for me after ipi-nivo or a second-line drug after cabo-nivo or pembroaxi. Now, the complication is if you give pembro and lenvatinib, what do you do in the second line is a little bit more complex that we'll have to break down in the future once we've had time to settle in with this data set. But to me, I think that was really exciting, moving HIF further up earlier in the paradigm.
So, Ben, to ask you, what I'm hearing you tell me, lenvatinib is no longer the automatic second line default, number one.
What I'm saying for now, cabozantinib is in a study with a HIP inhibitor called casdatifan in the PEAK-1 study. So we might have another HIF-TKI combination in the near future. And then all of a sudden, we have more choices again. And that will help us with sequencing.
Yep. But what you're also telling me is that HIF-2 now became a mainstream earlier line of therapy as opposed to being thought of as third line and beyond therapy from 6 months a year ago. So now we've really moved up the paradigm in terms of how were you thinking about HIF2 inhibition in RCC in general as a class effect.
Yes. And, you know, if it's okay for me to jump, move it up even further. And this one, I think, is going to be more controversial, though.
But I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
I have a question for you. What do you think? I know you briefly hinted on this, but what do you think is actually going to be second-line therapy in RCC? And you made a statement earlier that says MLEN, if you use that first line, it's a little bit more challenging.
Yeah.
How would you think about, you know, previously we've talked about if patients progressed on adjuvant pembrolizumab, we could potentially add something in to pembrolizumab, depending on the time of progression, to say that they maybe not progress on IO monotherapy and had micrometastatic disease, where you can add in the TKI and kind of reinduce the response as opposed to dropping your IO. In this kind of situation where somebody's on PEM-LEN, would you think about dropping PEM and adding in BEL to the LEN-BET?
Yeah, I think depending how they're progressing. So if you have somebody who's progressing mildly, I think it would be more reasonable to do that than to drop the LEN, continue on the pembro and do something else, right? I think the belzutifan is going to have more of an effect in that situation. And I think the IO is probably worth dropping to get that belzutifan potential response. That being said, I think we do not know. I would certainly add in belzutifan before I added in everolimus. Would I switch completely from lenvatinib to, say, cabo or monotherapy belzutifan? You can make both those arguments, right? Because you can give belzutifan in the second line, technically. So traditionally we haven't. I think the answer is depending how they're progressing, I think it would be reasonable, but that's why I really can't wait to have hopefully another combination in this space to make that choice easier, right? To have another partner with a HIF inhibitor. But for now, and I know Dr. Motzer, who helped lead this study, suggested that that's a very reasonable approach and something he does right. Well. And I think for that reason, I think it's totally reasonable because alternatively, you're switching just to a TKI monotherapy. Now, if a patient's rapidly progressing, I think that would be a bad idea, right? And then I would try to salvage them with, say, cabozantinib. I don't think HIF is good as an inhibitor for a rapidly progressing cancer in general, based on how it works. But again, I don't think until we know, we really know. And right now, we're in the gray area of a shifting landscape of kidney cancer care.
And then where do you see everolimus at this point?
I think everolimus is gone. I don't see where I would use it at this point.
I would agree.
Really bad COPD. I don't know. Something like that. If you come up with a patient where we're really concerned about hypoxia, but honestly, you can give the bell and you can stop it. So it's hard for me to see where I would give everolimus.
Yeah, I completely agree. But I'll let you go back to your adjuvant space that you were just referring to a little while ago.
Yeah,
about the
022, LightSpark 022. So I got the numbers right. So this is, you know, a really, it's somewhat a controversial study, but a really good study because, you know, we've talked on ad nauseum about perioperative RCC and the failures of immunotherapy with failure of ipi-nivo for 6 months, failure of nivo for 6 months, failure of atezolizumab for a year, failure of a perioperative immunotherapy approach with a couple doses of neoadjuvant immunotherapy followed by adjuvant. And we have this standalone positive study with adjuvant pembro for 1 year. But then it came along and we saw that durvalumab was positive. So, okay, it wasn't just on its own. But what this trial did, it took the backbone where some, you know, I was using adjuvant pembro, you were using adjuvant pembro, we're big believers in it. But there were some, you know, good kidney cancer doctors that were not. But there's no third arm here. This is just pembro versus pembro bell. So it's taking, all right, we had a positive study, let's build upon it. And that's how I would have designed the study. But I know there's a couple of doctors out there who would have done things a little bit differently with a third arm here. Again, going up against, you know, placebo, which I think is unnecessary given the survival advantage with pembro. And what you saw was the combination of pembrolizumab and belzutifan is better than the combination of pembrolizumab. Now, we don't have median numbers because they're not reached yet because so many patients do so well. We haven't crossed those medians yet. But the hazard ratio for disease-free survival is 0.72, very statistically significant. The hazard ratio for median OS is 0.12. So not statistically significant yet, but trending in the right direction and trending quite well in the right direction. Now, this does come at the toxicity cost, right? Grade 3 adverse events are a little over 50% for the combination versus about a third for the monotherapy. And that's because belzutifan has all the anemia associated with it, requiring transfusions, and some of the other fatigue and hypoxia was also greater with that combination. But overall, belzutifan, pretty reasonable to manage. I think now going forward, without a true statistically significant overall survival advantage, what we have to ask ourselves as a community of oncologists is disease-free survival enough to intensify therapy for a year with a pill that does have reasonable toxicity levels? And you know, I think we'll see what overall survival looks like as it matures, and we'll see what the FDA decides to do with disease-free survival alone, right? But I think the question will be, is this enough? And I know my personal opinion, but you know I like to talk. So I'm going to ask you what your opinion is first.
Yeah, I think it's actually reasonable. And I say that because we've done that with pembrolizumab when it first came out on KEYNOTE-564, right? We started using pembrolizumab based on DFS data, and that led to the approval. We know the toxicity was manageable, but we saw that there was some real toxicity even in there. But the question was always, was it the more advanced patients that carried the benefit with pembrolizumab for the DFS, as opposed to a true stage 3 patient, could have been more the M1 patients that didn't have any disease left, but that carried the benefit over. I think the question here is really going to be, who actually needs the escalation from single agent pembrolizumab versus going to the doublet when you're thinking about the overtreatment risk given the more toxicity with the belzutifan. While it may be mild and it's usually manageable, it does add more, right? You mean the hypoxia and the anemia are probably the biggest challenges. I tend to see that a little bit more just because I'm at a higher altitude than you are, and I have patients that go up even higher. So I think that for me is probably going to be a little bit more challenging, but it's certainly something that is manageable. And these patients are healthier, right? They're generally much healthier than your patients that are more advanced, have gone through first line or even second line therapy, where we're used to managing belzutifan at that point. So I think this is going to be beneficial, but I think the biggest challenge is going to be figuring out who actually needs the escalation. And if I had to make the decision today, I'd probably prefer and do it for those patients that are truly M1 that were either treated based on the oligometastatic definition and kind of treating them as a pseudo adjuvant where they had a metatectomy or radiotherapy. Or if they had a higher grade, or if they had sarcomatoid, rhabdoid features, then those are probably the patients that I'm going to do more of an escalation for, as opposed to clear cell RCC, grade 2, no sarcomatoid, no rhabdoid features, and, you know, no nodes or anything like that. Those patients I'm probably going to go more towards pembro alone, but I don't know if that's how it's going to be in the next few months, but that's kind of where I'm thinking right now.
Yeah. Can I needle you a little bit?
Yeah, of course.
Little needles. A lot of failures in the TKI space, right? And HIF is more like a TKI. HIF inhibitors are more like VEGF inhibition than immunotherapy. Granted, is complete. But a lot of failures with a lot of TKIs. And the only pseudo-positive one was ESTRAG. With a year of sunitinib, which basically delayed, no overall survival, but delayed your recurrence for about the year that you were on therapy, right? So give it therapy now, give therapy later, whatever. And that's why we don't use that drug. But HIF is somehow different to your eyes. We don't need overall survival.
Well, it's trending in the...
ESTRAC all over again.
No, I don't know if it's ESTRAC all over again. I think we had multiple different trials that looked at us, the TKIs. And the sunitinib is not a clean TKI. When you're looking at the HIF inhibition, they're much more targeted. They're not as quote-unquote dirty drugs, right? So they're much cleaner in terms of their effect. And when you're looking at the trend on the overall survival, it's actually trending much better than when you look at the ESTRAC data or any of the TKI data. We have not seen that previously. So I think that's the reason why I'm saying that. But is that going to pan out? I don't know. Maybe it'll be that we do this now or think about doing this now, but when the overall survival data comes back and it says, well, there's actually no difference in overall survival, toxicity on longer term is actually worse, then that answers the question that, yeah, we should not be doing this, right? Because
go ahead. Finish.
No, go ahead.
I sounded skeptical. I was just being a devil's advocate. I agree with you. I think it's
totally fine. I think
overall survival is going to pan out. And I think it is cleaner. I think it's different. And yeah. And I personally, if it gets FDA approved, will use it. I agree with you. It's complicated on who do we give it to. And I'm just going to throw in a little bit of nuance, which makes me give pause, right? Agree T4s, no positives, probably T3Bs, right? These patients with bulkier disease that are more likely to have cells left behind at the time of surgery, right? Those are clearly patients that I think intensify. And then you start talking about the histology question. And then that's when I really don't know, like these nomograms that we use, that some of us use, I don't use them, but the Assure nomograms and the MSK nomograms, right? These nomograms that we're supposed to use to predict recurrence really rely on the grade, the histology, the sarcomatoid rhabdoid, grade 4, whatever it may be, the Furman grade. HIF inhibitors, theoretically, to me, scientifically, might work better in those with lower grade tumors because they're going to be more addicted to HIF signaling than sarcomatoid and rhabdoid. Now, if you look at the forest plot that Dr. Shwari presented at the stage, I don't think we see a signal that it's not going to work in sarcomatoid rhabdoid versus the other. I think we need to wait for more development, but I think it's going to be harder to pick who should get these drugs, at least initially, because it is going to be the higher rate risk of recurrences in those patients with the bad biology, but perhaps the drug's going to work even better in the patients with the good biology. I just don't think we know. I think it's really interesting because immunotherapy is going to work better in the bad biology patients. So stay tuned for us to decode that when we figure it out. We got to figure it out first, though. We got to figure it out.
I totally understand. I agree with you completely on that one. I just don't know that I have anything else to add to that block.
Yeah. But. Okay, so that's kidney. I think we did kidney. So I think there's probably two things we should talk about in prostate cancer. Obviously, there was a lot of studies, but let's talk about two. We talked in the conference hall, right? You know, in person chatting, and you seem excited somewhat about piece three worth talking about. I think it's interesting. So why don't you tell us about piece three?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that. It's just an interesting style of study in that we looked at piece three now, which is looking at enzalutamide and radium 223. And it's basically looking and it showed that there's now an overall survival benefit. Now, is it really going to change anything from how we approach this or what does it mean for patients and from a treatment standpoint? I don't know that it changes anything because it is basically telling us that we can use radiopharmaceuticals earlier, but we're already doing that from lutetium anyway with LU-177, and we're using it so much earlier that we're using it even in the hormone sensitive space, right? So potentially. So I don't know that it changes anything. It's just that this now showed that there is a survival benefit. So that for the patients that we don't have at this point or don't fit other treatment options, this certainly could be an option for them to utilize radium plus ENZA as a potential option of therapy. That's really where I think it was. It was just that we tend, you know, seeing the overall survival benefit in castration-resistant prostate cancer, we don't see that often. And now we've seen it in the resistant disease. Even though it's only for bone-only disease, it's still a meaningful endpoint where, you know, we always want these patients to do better. I think it's an important thing to highlight.
So I think you're underselling it a little bit. You know, I was kind of joking, but also, you know me, You know, radium-223 is a drug that, you know, kind of lost a little bit of its excitement when lutetium came out. I mean, look, lutetium had an overall survival benefit with vision, but failed so far to show an overall survival benefit in the pre-chemo MCRPC space and failed to show it again in the hormone sensitive space, though that data is immature, right? That's beta radioligand emission, which is a little different than alpha radioligand emission, which is a stronger punch, just shorter diameter. You know, going back to Alstimcla, where radium-223 initially showed an overall survival benefit, well, now it showed it again. So is it radium-223 versus lutetium? Is it the easier space they went into, which is post-ADT monotherapy, right? That is a slightly different space than the PSMA-4 lutetium space, which was post-ARPI. So there's a lot of ifs, but also is it telling us in the future that some of these actinium molecules and some of these alpha emitters that are going to come in, you know, without a targeting PSMA, are those going to be very exciting? I think it's maybe a story to come that perhaps there's better radiation to give than beta lutetium, which is, you know, what we have with Pluvicto. And I will say, I think if you're progressing on ADT monotherapy, there's not that many out there that are treated in our clinics, but there are a lot out there in the community. So I think it's a great option for those patients and even to be considered, and this might be the ENZA and then add in the radium-223. You have to give bone modifying agents with these drugs, high fracture rates, But I think if you do that, I think that would be reasonable and would be even reasonable to consider that in place of lutetium in that space if they're post-abiraterone, though I don't think we know. But I think both would be reasonable, assuming they have bone-only disease, right? It has to be bone-only disease. It does not work outside the bones. Calcium mimetic required to bring that radiation in. So I think that's good. So, you know, it's a reasonable trial to discuss because I think it tells us a lot about what might be coming in the future. And we could give that drug as FDA approved. And I want to end on a final note here, and it's a terminology update. So, you know, for those of you that are listening that are involved in clinical research, in prostate cancer, our lives are harder because we can't just follow RECIST criteria. We have to follow prostate cancer working group 3 criteria because of the way we follow bone radiographs and had the flare response in the bone scans that can be confused for progression when in fact it can be response. Well, now we have PCWG4. And we're not going to go into all the details because that's a clinical trial conversation. There will be more PET imaging involved, hopefully, in all future trials. I think that's one of the very important things in PCWG4. But for those of you who are practicing that are not involved in clinical trials, I think there might be a terminology change. We might be moving away from castration-resistant, hormone-resistant, castration-sensitive, hormone-sensitive to a more complicated terminology set. Androgen pathway modulation naive, androgen pathway modulation sensitive, and androgen pathway modulation resistant, okay? And that's to move away, one, from the, I think there was a lot of conversations with patient advocates about moving away from certain terminology that was felt to be insensitive, but also maybe more rational in the future as we move away from what we're currently doing in therapy. Androgen pathway modulation could apply to AR inhibitors, right? It could apply to AR degraders. It could apply to traditional androgen deprivation therapy. So it's going to get complicated between sensitive and naive, but it's going to be there because we know we have in the EMBARK data set patients on enzalutamide monotherapy, right? Not on ADT, right? So that's different, right? We're going to have patients that are potentially treated with other types of AR-based drugs. Not only to mention, we talked about the degraders that aren't FDA approved, but there's RipTax targeting AR. There's other things targeting AR that make the two of us who are researchers quite excited about what the future might hold. So terminology change may be affecting the way we speak to patients in our clinics. So instead of saying you're hormone sensitive, we might be saying you're APMS, right? Androgen pathway modulation sensitive. So stay tuned for a lot of refreshers and dictionary work as we get our heads around what this means. But I do think that's an important update that's coming out of this conference that's now published.
I agree with you completely. I think it's going to take some time for adoption for this, not only from a research standpoint or even assessing response, but just to make it more vernacular.
Yeah, I agree. It's important. And I'll tell you, I was late from clinic today, and Manoj was so gracious for me to be 20 minutes late. But, you know, I was talking to a newly diagnosed prostate cancer patient, and I said the word hormone sensitive. So it's going to take us all some time to wrap our hands around this, the vocabulary term. But I think it will become at some point, most likely, pretty commonplace. Now, that might take a couple of years.
Yep. Agree. Well, I think those were all the big highlights from ASCO GU. I know we gave some of our tidbits in along the way for this episode. We are going to break down some of this a little bit further. Specifically, we'll talk about the adjuvant space and what does it mean for HIF inhibition in kidney cancer, along with some other topics that have been coming up in the next few weeks. Ben, any other final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think we're good and we're excited in 3 months for ASCO.
That's right. And where we'll probably see more data and change the landscape again. So thank you all for listening and for your support. Please follow us at Oncology Decoded on X, as well as email us at podcast@oncologydecoded.com. And we'll look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thank you.